let me echo his statement that I'm only just now in the last 4 minutes realizing that I'm here.
He doesn't
have
any
time to adjust to that.
He's also giving a talk at 2 o'clock because nobody has.
Okay, so what I would like to talk about is some compactification effects in string inflation. In other words, how the details of string compactification interact with attempts to make inflationary models. So the key question to start the subject is, what predictions can string theory make about the early universe? And unfortunately, the answer to date is, there is no universal prediction, much though we would like it. A universal prediction, some generic prediction of string theory for inflation would be very useful because it would create falsifiability for the whole theory. What we have now is falsifiability for individual models. So predictions are possible in concrete models. And that's what I want to talk about. The reason progress is not amazingly fast is that even given a model, once you've specified some configuration of brains, some compactification, the choice of modulus that's going to correspond to the inflaton, it's not trivial to get the right effective field theory. And of course, everyone can do the dimensional reduction to get the leading terms in the effective theory. The problem is that for inflation, you actually need the leading Planck suppressed terms. And that's not trivial. You need to look into corrections to the Keller potential, corrections to the superpotential. So I'll explain that today and then do that in one case. So, as we all know, inflation is a period of accelerated expansion that solves the Big Bang puzzles. Explains why the universe is large, flat, and empty. And I would say generically, although some might argue, inflation predicts minute variations in the CMB temperature that are not quite scale invariant. And indeed, that's what's observed, or at least what's favored by the WMAP-free data, not precisely scale invariant. And this is in the eyes of many, a striking bit of evidence in the corner of inflation, although by no means a confirmation of inflation. So what we'd like to do is, in inflation generally, but my point of view, particularly in attempting to connect inflation and string theory, make very precise predictions in exactly this vein and test them against future data. So we have this beautiful picture. And I'd like to ask, what would we have to understand in order to say, what would we have to know to say that we really understand where this is coming from? It's perfectly consistent with our theories. My standard would be we should have a derivation of some picture like that in a rigorous context where everyone agrees on the rules and there's no possibility of fighting about them or debating which kinds of ingredients should or should not be included. It should just be rigorous. Personally, I think it would be nice to have ultraviolet control, best in some sort of quantum gravity theory. And then the essential thing is making specific predictions. Just to frame this a little bit, there are plenty of cases where people can be talking about different models, or people can have the same model, the same configuration of objects, and nevertheless not agree on what the predictions are. And this is, of course, not a satisfactory status for the science. One has to keep going until the predictions converge and everyone agrees. Then you can test it against experiment. It's way too early. All practitioners do not agree. I think that making firm predictions with small error bars doesn't really happen. I'm not going to do it today, but I'll lead the way in warp brain context for the reason is a fair one though. It's not because people aren't doing something right. It's if you specify a broad framework and don't have detailed access to all the microphysical parameters, then, as you know well, there's some sort of parameter space of models. And within that parameter space, you have a wide range of predictions. On the other hand, most likely all of those parameters are really discretely tuned in string theory, and once you get down to the microphysical level, for all parameters, you may be able to find a discrete set of predictions. And if you're lucky, they may be well-spaced apart. That's sort of what I have in mind. But that would be another talk to really think about. Why is this anything that wasn't done from the early days of inflation? Well, of course, these ideas were known then. But what's changed since then is a lot of progress in string theory, in particular in moduli stabilization. and the observations are getting better, so it's only so long that we can do this before they won't be predictions anymore. So how is string inflation doing? Well, it is indeed a rigorous context with clear rules, of course, full quantum gravity theory, and making specific reliable predictions is certainly achievable in almost all the models, in any well-specified model. But on the other hand, that hasn't been done in quite all the models yet, so there's a lot of work. So today, I want to talk about inflation for D3 grains. So in the part two of the talk, I'll explain the setup and the problem, much of which is well known to some of you. And then in the third part, I'll talk about how to actually compute the D3 grain potential and see what that involves. So let me stress, there are lots and lots and lots of interesting string inflation models that are not D-brain models, but I will not talk about them. So brain inflation models involving D-brains, I'm going to focus on warp brain anti-brain models today, but this is just to give you an idea of some of the various scenarios people have thought of. The picture is something like this. Over here, there's a bulk of a Calabi-Yau manifold, some type 2B or antifold fluxes. And here, the blue dot is a D3 brain, the red dot an anti-D3 brain, and then this shape here is a warp throw. For example, like Fermanov stress throw, something like that, something generalized. And this picture here indicates that these brains are filling 3+1 dimensions, so the motion of the blue dot, the motion of the D3 brain, is a four-dimensional field. So why did I start with this picture? Why didn't I just remove the warp region and just talk about brain and anti-brain in default? That was what was proposed by Dabali and Tai in 98. And the problem is the Coulomb potential in unwarped space is typically too steep. So it doesn't have the nice flatness properties that are required for a successful inflation model. On the other hand, in a warp background, the exponential warping, at least naively, makes the potential exponentially flat. Another perhaps overlooked reason is that this is really a local model with explicit metrics. We're coupling it to a ball, but in this local region, we can do exact computations. And that's a serious advantage. And then there are some phenomenological advantages or reasons for finding it interesting. It has an RS-like hierarchy, so you can control the scales. And one particularly interesting thing that that leads to is the possibility of cosmic superstrings with a tension that's not yet ruled out. If you didn't have warping, the cosmic superstring tension would be very large, and they would be already excluded. So that was, in particular, the reason why there wasn't much interest in cosmic superstrings before, say, 5 years ago or something. Sorry. I stress this, of course, there's plenty of interest in cosmic strings, but cosmic superstrings were not such a question. So the problem, why are we not happy yet with this model? Well, moduli stabilization is not a trivial ingredient. Even though it's known more or less how to accomplish it, it has to be done explicitly to have a realistic model. And the stabilization moduli is necessary for physical reasons. It can spoil EVN, it can overclose the universe, if you have fifth force couplings, all sorts of things like that. And really, the reason that moduli stabilization and inflation are interacting is that during inflation, any light moduli will be displaced from their eventual minimum, will be storing energy. Then as inflation ends, they'll be stranded far away from the minimum and need to relax to it. In the process, release energy, and that can cause some of these problems, or the BPM, or the universe. So it's not really consistent to talk about an inflationary model with moduli that are not included explicitly. Okay, the problem is moduli stabilization by a known mechanism, the most popular one being the KKLT mechanism, spoils the flatness. So where we started out, we had a proposal, at least, for a configuration where the potential for the inflaton could be relatively flat, as desired for slow roll inflation. We need to stabilize the moduli. Fine. We know how to stabilize the moduli. Doing it, we find the potential is no longer flat. So the remainder of the talk will be asking, if we really compute in detail the corrected potential in the stabilized vacuum, in other words, we include all the effects of moduli stabilization, what comes out? Can it ever be an inflationary model? Can we exclude the possibility? We just have to compute the potential to find out. So the picture should really change. The corrected picture is one in which the moduli stabilization effects are actually included explicitly. So what I've drawn here is a wrapped brain, by which I mean a Euclidean D3 brain for a stack of D7 brains. In either case, wrapping a 4-cycle. The KKLT proposal is that wrap brains of that sort generate a non-perturbative superpotential that can stabilize the Campbell modulon. So now, having shown the picture, let me explain that a little bit. I'll come to that in just a moment. So the question is, what is the potential for a D3 brain's motion in a KKLT magnification, a non-perturbatively stabilized plastic? And let me stress, although the problem came up for us first in the context of trying to compute the implicon potential, this actually says something about other kinds of things you can do with D3 brains. Because what we're going to compute is the D3 brain potential in a stabilized flexible magnification. So that means, in particular, that this tells you where D3 brains can sit in such a magnification. It lifts the D3 brain moduli space. So it's actually an open string moduli stabilization mechanism for D3 brains. So there's some interesting related work, in particular the paper of Burakak and Kors did what I'm going to do in a different technique for toroidal cases. And I'll show how to generalize that. So here's a warm-up for everybody. You consider type 2b a Galois oriented fold with free-form flux. Then the equation of motion tells you that the flux has to be imaginary self-field, i.e. it should obey this condition here. But it's been shown by Granula and by Granula, Grimm, Knockers, and Lewis that the fields on a D3 brain do not couple to that component. So in a background with only ISD flux, there's nothing to which the D3 brain fields can couple. So the D3 brain moves freely. All of the scalars on its world volume are free fields. And its moduli space is its whole configuration space. There's nowhere where it could, in principle, go with any energy that it doesn't go just on the moduli space. You can see this is a cancellation between the Bordenfeld and Schoen-Simons terms in the action governing D3 brain motion. And it's sort of a DPS-like property, but let me stress, it doesn't require unbroken superstring. So the picture is now just, I just have a, in principle, supersymmetric configuration, or main non-supersymmetric, with a D3 brain, and it can move freely, can probe the entire Calabian. Its moduli space is the Calabian. That is not true when we include moduli stabilization effects. So let me recall how this goes. In type 2b, there are both complex structure moduli and cable moduli, and in addition, there's a dilaton. And the addition of generic freeform fluxes lifts the complex structure moduli and lifts the dilaton, and leaves the cable moduli on. So the KKLT scenario is to stabilize the cable moduli by adding non-perturbative effects of the sort I described before, rack brains, Euclidean D3 brains, or a stack of D7 brains. In either case, wrapping a 4-cycle in the Calabian and filling, in the D7 brain case, filling space. These same non-perturbative effects lift the D3 brain moduli.
Why do Kähler moduli not lifted by the flux?
The Kähler moduli cannot actually, they don't appear in the flux. So the flux superpotential is just the Gukov-Hoppe-Witten term, integral G wedge omega, and is necessarily no perturbative correction, so that superpotential can depend on the Kähler moduli. So only a non-perturbative correction can depend on the Kähler moduli because of the axion shift symmetry associated with the partners of the Kähler moduli. So those forbid the Kähler moduli from appearing in the flux superpotential.
Is that not the same thing as saying that you want to turn on free-form fields, and so that's 3 cycles that get stabilized and 2 cycles that do with the Kähler moduli?
Well, those statements are certainly true, but I don't think that.
In
2A models, you certainly can. I don't know if a flux can turn on in 2B that will solve, that will actually lift those problems. But it is, yes. So, indeed, the Kähler moduli do, some of the Kähler moduli can indeed appear in the flux superpotential in type 2A. But in type 2B, where I'm working here, there are no fluxes that can turn on that stabilize them.
The permittivity condition that also might
The permittivity condition, namely the condition that G with J should be trivial, where J is the Kähler form, is this is a biform, so it's automatically trivial in a genuine draw the out. This is something which one always has to take care of in a tutorial compacted case. That'll be in sort of the general. Yeah, other questions about this? So this is, since this is sort of the thing on which I'm building, so let me make sure it's clear to everybody.
The stuff in the previous slide is not ruined by the type, the complex, the flux didn't stabilize the complex structure. The one you're focused on as being problem, changing things is the non-derivative thing that gets the cater.
Precisely. So this is the deterministic ISD flux, which is the only kind of flux allowed by equations of motion. If you turn on that kind of flux, the complex structure moduli are lifted. The dilaton is lifted. Remaining are the Kähler moduli and, as we see, the deterministic moduli. So if we're doing this in steps, you start with an empty Calabi-Yau, you turn on ISD three-form flux. Complex structure moduli are gone, dilaton is gone, remaining Kähler moduli, and this goes. Other questions? So our task is to include this effect and then compute the result. Let me say a little bit more about these non-perturbative effects. I just have to introduce the notation for how this superpotential depends on the various ingredients. But I have a general warped line element like this. Y are the coordinates on the internal space, H is the warp factor. And I can define an object VW, the warped volume of a cycle, the warped volume here of a force cycle, is the integral over that force cycle of the warp factor. That's a natural enough definition. And this is a definition here for the Gaugino condensate superpotential, which should be familiar from the low energy theory, from four dimensional gauge theory. On the other hand, if you were asked to write down the action for Euclidean D3 brains, probably you would guess that the action would be proportional to the D3 brain tension and then to the size of the cycle that's being
wrapped. And what is the condition for the force cycle?
The condition for the condition for the force cycle is that it should lift in F32 a force cycle of arithmetic genus 1, or well, I guess they call it holomorphic Euler character 1. But what I will not be, that is the condition in the absence of flux. In the presence of flux, the condition is modified.
But you are not doing F theory. So
well, this is type 2 beyond an oriented fold of a Calabi-Yau, which could be a limit of some F theory.
But that, is it always a limit of some F theory?
I can afford to only consider those that because after every F theory magnification will have an oriented fold. So I can be thinking of working in the oriented limit of some particular F theory construction. And then I have a definition of the right condition. But let me stress something important now that you brought this up. The question relates to what is the condition for Euclidean ether grain grabbing a force cycle? So this is the classical action for this grain. On the other hand, an integral over fermion zero modes can give a zero superpotential for the Euclidean grains. And the question one always has to check is there going to be a non-zero effect or not? I'm not going to check that here. What I'm going to do, what we did in this analysis, is study four cycles that mock up Euclidean D3 brains. In other words, that have roughly the same properties, in particular, four cycles that are holomorphic. But there's an undetermined prefactor in front, which can be zero. So what I'm giving is the rules for computing the interaction between a D3 brain and a wrapped brain. If the wrapped brain generates a zero superpotential because of too many fermion zero modes, then the interaction is zero. So it's only in the case where this wrapped brain generates a non-zero superpotential that this effect is relevant at all. You don't even have to do a computation if there's a zero precondition. Okay, but I will not anymore talk about that precondition. I will just say, given a concrete scenario, of course, the first thing you check is the prefactor of the superpotential zero? If it is, you haven't even stabilized the associated modulus. So you have a runaway direction.
Oh, they're both the same.
Yes.
So does this cycle have to be isolated?
Well, I'm not sure that that's exactly equivalent, but certainly one of the necessary conditions. So if the cycle is not isolated, then its deformations will have fermionic partners. Those fermionic partners will give fermion zero modes and give zero superpotential. So what I will be talking about is cycles that are merely holomorphic. And what one can do is, given a study of... So there exists no study in the literature of a background with a warp throat and moduli stabilization. So once such a study is performed, you could very easily feed this in and compute the interaction between D3 brains and wrapped brains in that background. But what we haven't done is a very hard technical task of really constructing a magnification with a warp throat and stabilizing the moduli. Okay, we're just exhibiting the tools for finding the interaction when such a thing exists. Yeah, that's an important point. So thank you. Now, in either case, it turns out by changing notation here a little bit and just checking the dimension of reduction, you find that the non-perturbative superpotential in either the D7 or the Euclidean D3 case looks like this. And let me stress the all-important fact that the volume that appears here upon just dimensional reduction, we're not adding anything, dimensionally reducing, is the work volume, not the regular volume. So the KKLT proposal is that the superpotential is first the Kähler-independent Gukov-Hoppe-Witten part, Q by omega, plus the non-perturbative part. And in their language, for those who are familiar with their notation, the non-perturbative term has a prefactor. It is written in terms of the prefactor A, where A in the KKLT scenario is taken to be. So if you're familiar with their scenario, you can think of what we're doing as computing the non-trivial dependence of A, which isn't really a constant, computing the non-trivial dependence of A on the D3 gradient position. So as the D3 gradient moves around, the prefactor of the superpotential changes. So many of that. Okay, so here's the same line element, I'm just copying it so that you don't have to remember it. If you include the back reaction of a D3 brain on this domain, the D3 brain sources work factor, right? You know, if you take a stack of D3 brains, you get some 8H5 plus S5, or you put them at a singularity, you get something else. In each case, they're sourcing H. So what we've done so far, I've been talking about work for a background and a probe D3 brain. By going away from the probe approximation, I'll be able to compute the effectiveness. So by going away from the probe approximation, I mean I'm going to take the work factor H and actually let it depend on the D3 brain position. In other words, I'm going to include the effect of the D3. Yeah.
So if you go one page back.
Yeah.
So in order to stabilize the modulo, you needed to add the non-perturbative effect. So that will have also the effect on the background, which. Are you ignoring it? So I still, because if you include that effect, what would happen is that the flux is no longer ISD flux.
Exactly.
And the manifold is no longer called the VR.
That's an important one.
Much more profound.
It's not. We checked. So let me repeat that point in case the question wasn't clear. If the condition that the equations of motion make the flux ISD is true in the absence of non-perturbative effects. In the presence of non-perturbative effects, the flux gets a small IASD part, an imaginary anti-self-loop piece. And you might think that would actually cause the leading effect on the D3 brains. But we just checked. The scaling, it scales in such a way that the leading effect is always from the corrections to the superpotential. And there's sort of a way of seeing that, which is you put in the non-perturbative superpotential, and here's a correction, a multiplicative correction in that term itself. If you include the back reaction of the non-perturbative superpotential, that's suppressed by one additional order. And effectively, getting IASD fluxes then suppressed by one additional order. But it had to be checked, and we did check.
Right. And another thing is, so that the discussion as it is now, you will not get a Kissinger-like background, right?
Right, so certainly not.
So and you will talk about the back reaction of the anti-D3 brain as well.
Well, the back reaction of the anti-D3 brain affects, as you know well, affects the four-dimensional slices. However, it doesn't affect, it affects the potential for the D3 brain in a calculable way, just compute the interaction between them. And that's been done in previous work. What we don't have to compute is the effect of the anti-D3 on the non-perturbative superpotential, because we're trying to extract the leading effect correcting the D3 brain potential. And what you're describing would be a correction to, say, the topological constant.
Well, we saw the D3 brain including the non-perturbative effect and the D3 brain, at least in the region where you are looking at the geometry will have a plastic effect, right? So there will be like a huge data problems.
Sure. So the.
When you see it with the discussion.
I won't talk about that much in this talk. What I will be addressing is the basic point that if in a supersymmetric construction there exists no moduli space for the D3 brain and the D3 brain potential is steep, then that's enough to rule out the construction. And I will then talk about how you might tweak things in the construction such that you can restore a moduli space. If you can restore an almost moduli space, then one has to address your question. Okay, so I'm looking at something that would be more immediately available. Mm-hmm. Any more questions? Okay. So what am I trying to do then? H depends on, has a piece contributed by the D3 gradient. And so the work volume of the force cycle gets a piece where I integrate that small correction over the force cycle itself. So the scenario is that I have some sort of force cycle out here inside the Calabi-Yau, and a D3 brain, and maybe extending into the warp region too, and a D3 brain, here's the raft brain, and emanating from the D3 brain is a small correction to the warp factor. When that small correction corrects the background here, it changes the size of the force cycle, and hence changes the classical action, hence changes the strength of the non-perturbative effect. So I'm going to compute a Green's function for the D3 brain warp factor and integrate that Green's function over this cycle, and that will tell me how much of the D3 brain's presence correct the
model. That volume and the non-perturbative thing are now x dependent.
Yeah, exactly. So delta V here is going to be an x dependent.
Yeah, you're integrating over y, but not x.
Absolutely. Right. I want to leave x at a fixed position and then ask, what's the, I'll compute the energy and then I'll consider that'll be the potential at when the brain hits at x.
So root g, you're going to not imagine depending on x.
Here?
Yeah.
Root g. No, because the leading correction is the fact that it's going to cause those warp, not a correction to the unwarped part of the measure.
I thought there was a discussion in your paper about there being a cancellation between non-homomorphic terms that are partly coming from changes to G and partly coming from changes to H, so they could exactly be the same size for that term.
Okay, so that's actually a... No, that's a change to the overall Cayley modulus, canceling it. So let me not get into that now. That is a correction. The two corrections that are competing against each other, there is one that's a correction to the volume, a non-homomorphic piece in the volume, and the other is a correction to the warp factor. It's not a sort of an unwarped metric versus warp factor.
But when you say volume, I'm thinking it's volume computed with G.
Oh, those... the overall reading mode of the whole space pulls out of all particles.
Right. And but is that inside G or do you normally?
So that will be consistently incorporated. So I'm pulling out the full corrected particles. And if delta H contributes in just such a way that it restores holomorphy, but it leaves a non-trivial holomorphic residue, which is the effect of interest. So any non-holomorphic pieces that I would compute here will indeed be canceled, but then I'm going to get a holomorphic.
So I should be thinking of G having a normalization condition, so I'll just remove the overall reading in root G.
Yes. If you like, that's going to be implicit in everything. I'm not going to express that at every stage.
Maybe a related question is that the first lines that you wrote, right? So if you write down the equation of motion, that is a consistent way of doing it as long as the four-dimensional space has a constant curvature. So any, if you have some non-trivial dynamics, like, this is no longer a prior decomposition of the metric.
Right, so what we're computing is the static potential. Yeah. Yeah. So, indeed, of course, it's best to have something that have a consistent enough that's valid along a whole trajectory, but what I'm computing is the potential at once. So it's sufficient to use this. Any more questions? This is the proposal, although I'll repeat it here repeating the equations that you just saw before, and then here showing what is this delta H? Well, delta H, the D3 bin is a point source. So it solves some, the delta H solves some Laplace equation. Here's the Laplace equation. The strength of it is the 10-dimensional coupling kappa 10 squared times the D3 bin tension T3. And so it's a delta function source, but then there's a background charge which is necessary to satisfy Gauss's law. Of course, you can't have just one point in a compact space with nothing. And what is rho background? Well, the good thing is it doesn't matter. Our result is independent of what the background charge is. However, the background charge just has to be something that integrates to one. Okay, so if you want to, what should you be thinking of the background charge as being? Well, it can be an antibrain far away. It can be some dissolved fluxes that carry D3 brain charge. It can be some fluxes on some brain somewhere that have D3 brain charge. Any combination of objects you can think of that have a total amount of -1 unit of D3 brain charge. that's what we're after. So the proposal, then, is solve for delta H, solve this equation for delta H, integrate delta H over this score cycle here, and then read off the changes. The proposal clear?
You're not saying that you can choose row background. You're saying that it's the zero mode. And you're just projecting on the zero mode.
Well, it doesn't even have to be quite the zero mode. It can depend spatially, but
well, I mean zero mode not sense of constant mode, but the zero mode of delta there because that's
yes. Yes, we can indeed. That's effectively what. Any other questions about the proposal before I start to actually make it work? So, already said this. Let me skip over the very interesting word preferred after the course in the interest of showing you how to actually do it this way. What we really want to do is take this is a semi-honest cartoon, what we're thinking about. But we want to take it down to a lower caricature where we have an asymptotically conical space within a 10 set of brain, because there we have an explicit metric. And what we can show is that, so what approximation has been made here? Well, this tip has been ignored and been made singular, and this gluing region here has been ignored, effectively taken to infinity. And then we show in our paper that both of those effects don't give interesting corrections to gluing. So it's good enough to just use this as a possible problem. It wasn't clear to ignore it, but we did. So wrap brains and throats, well, now we need, so what is this red thing here? This is a wrap brain, like I was talking about before, but we need to know exactly where it's sitting. So here is some work by Aaron Brooks and Romalo that tells us some supersymmetric embeddings of D7 brains in first. And what I just want to call your attention to, here's a definition of some conifold variables, Wi. So this is the definition of the conifold. These are four complex variables. Here, for illustration, is what W1 is in terms of the usual variables, if you happen to be familiar with the conifold notation. But this is irrelevant. And Ariane Gruss and Romalo tell us that the following equations give supersymmetric embeddings of D7 brains. So they say pick four integers pi and pick a complex number mu that gives you a supersymmetric D7 brain if you embed it along this. This is one complex equation, so it's a divisor. So that's, and I'm going to call it sigma 4. This is where my ref brain is.
So in pure control, is this a non-compact cycle?
Yes. It extends all the way up, and the burden is on us, and we do show that the effect is localized in the region of interest in the throat and doesn't run off to infinity. If the effect were supported at infinity, we couldn't have computed the thing. We couldn't have done anything. It would have been silly to do to try to decouple the ball effect. Luckily, it does decouple. Okay, so here's the embedding, and well, in the singular conifold, you can, just to illustrate that you can indeed find the Green's function, it's effectively a six-dimensional Jackson problem. And here are the angular eigenfunctions, depending on psi alpha, can denote the phi angle on the base T11 of the conifold. So angular eigenfunctions, the normalization, and then some dependence on R, in other words, some radial function, whose weight depends on lambda L, which is the angular eigenfunction. So this is the thing. A fairly straightforward generalization of what we want to do in the NM. And here, the index L, this will be a little bit more important. The base of the conifold, which I'm just using as an example, the construction works for other things. The base of the conifold has symmetry SU2 times SU2 times U1. So we can decompose the angular eigenfunctions in terms of the quantum numbers of SU2 times SU2 times U1. So L is a multi-index that corresponds to the two azimuthal quantum numbers and the R charge. R. Okay, and sorry, please don't confuse this R with that R. I'll whatever it's the R charge, I'll tell you.
Not a great choice.
It's not an idea, but it's not at all. No, I probably shouldn't use capital R here. Okay, so luckily these formulas are not important in detail for the problem. Now the proposal here is to integrate that G, it's not that these wilds are some functions, there's some particular hypergeometric function which are given in our paper. So now we need to integrate those guys over this four cycle here. And I gave you the equation for the four cycle, so it's a principle specified. And let me just add one new piece of notation where G, since G is a sum over L, I can just define the Lth term in the sum integrated to be IL. And so when I will just talk about what are the ILs. When I computed all the ILs and add them up, I've got it. Okay, here's what was to us a big surprise. The ILs are almost all zero. Yes.
Isn't that a consequence of the orthogonality of the
spectral harmonics? No. Plenty of the zeros are indeed a consequence of that. So we found lots and lots of zeros that were of that form. But the vast majority are true for a non-trivial reason, which is not the orthogonality. So after exhausting orthogonality, we spent a whole week trying to convince ourselves that there must be some more subtle use of orthogonality that makes these things cancel. But as far as we can see, it's not. It requires more non-trivial identity about exactly what these functions.
So there's more beyond spherical orthogonals, beyond orthogonality of the harmonics. There's still more cancellations.
Many, many, many.
And there's a reason for this.
Yes. So what are the ones that don't cancel? They're the ones where L1 equals L2 equals R over 2. And to see what the reason was, we go to the dual description. So the dual description of a rope like this, you can talk about some here superconformal field theory. This is the Clebanov-Witten superconformal field theory that I'm talking about. And in other words, I'm not thinking about the running or the deformation at the tip this part anymore. And this is just for illustration for this slide only. So here, delta H can be described in terms of a sum over the expectation values of some gauge and drain operators. Those gauge and drain operators will have coefficient ci, and will multiply angular eigenfunctions fi, and those operators will have conformal weights delta I. So depending on what the conformal weight is, one has a higher power of R appearing in this expectation. So this is just a general way of writing this effect. Now, among all the gauge and drain operators, there's a very special subset. Those are the chiral ones, and those are the ones effectively which correspond to L1 equals L2 equals K over 2, where K is an integer. Sorry, now I have shifted to a better notation where this denotes the R chart. Sorry about that. So what we find is that, so these were exactly the ones that gave non-zero contribution to the input on the previous page. So what we find is the things that contribute are only the chiral operators. All the non-chiral ones, for reasons that still remain to us non-trivial, do not contribute. Now, if you wanted a sort of a story type reason of why this might have happened, you could say, well, it's pretty much because of holomorphy. We have some holomorphic cycle on the P3 brain that should be supersymmetric. But we didn't use supersymmetry, and in fact, could have broken supersymmetry in this background. So I'm not even sure that that's quite a convincing explanation. All we can say now is we can at least identify what are these special terms that do contribute, and we can prove definitively that the other terms don't. So the special terms that contribute are the chiral terms.
From the ADS-CFG, it's precisely what you said. What you are doing, you are going on the Coulomb branch.
Yep.
Of this Clebanov-Witten CFG.
Yes.
And so you ask what are the corrections. You basically ask what the non-trivial potential is. And so that can help on the Coulomb. Basically, corrections from the cargo operator. So
yeah.
I don't see why you don't like it. Just what you said.
So the homework question. Yeah. It may well be the correct explanation. Let's discuss that afterwards and see it. It certainly could be. We don't have the sharp evidence that it isn't. It's just that. What we were unable to do was to reconstruct any of the actual intervals that we had to perform that turned out mysteriously to be zero in such a way that they vanished because of the holomorphy. Mm-hmm. In other words, the holomorphy was mysterious to us through the whole thing. We knew we put in a holomorphic core cycle, and we knew what we were getting out. We supported only on chiral terms, but maybe if we tried much harder, we could find that we could explicitly see that it's because of holomorphy. But since the only reason I hesitate about that explanation is I can't prove it's the right explanation in this case because I haven't seen it. Okay, so the result for the countable case, so I told you that most of the IELTs here are zero. So let me compute the IELTs that are not zero, the chiral ones, and I get this. And then I can sum those up. And when I sum all those things up, I get log. So it's just the series expansion for log. All of those terms. That worked out nicely. But after all, this is what I'm computing here is T3 delta V4, which is the change in the instant time. So I need to exponentiate that to get the change in the superpotential. So I exponentiate log, and here's what I get. Now, let me take you back to something that may now look familiar. This thing here, the embedding condition for the D7 brain. So there's that, and now see the same thing appearing, only the n proved as the prefactor of the non-trivial system. So there was this whole mess in between all these other terms. The terms almost all cancel. Then of the terms that didn't cancel, they also must give a lock. When you actually initiate it, you get back not just any function, but you get back exactly the nth root of the embedding equation of this term. So the general result is if rat brains are embedded along f equals 0, then the superponential correction is f to the 1 over n, where n is the number of rat brains. N descent range from 1 to the integer. So we think that's sort of nice. Ganor had an extremely slick way of actually arriving at an answer like this for an only slightly restricted subcase, just using a monotony argument. So let me just credit him for a very, very clever result in 1996 and not actually go through the explanation of that, because I want to say what is it that this actually applies for the brain prediction. Yes?
Don't you know what they did by essentially mapping this four brain or this four cycle that you have in the conic fold? You go back to, so ask the question, where does this brain come from in the flat space picture of the Clement Putin theories living? I think the point is that if you integrate out the open strings between the D3 brain and the brain that corresponds to this non-compact cycle, you would get exactly this.
Ah, good. So I would not argue even for a moment in flat that would be the right thing in flat space. Whether that can be mapped properly back to the curved space is not clear. So yes, the physical effect going on here, if you like, in the case of the Gugino condensations, we have rat brains with the Gugino condensate living on the 7 brains. And between the D3 brain and this stack of D7 brains, there are 3 7 strings. And the theory living on these D7 brains in 4 dimensions is some SUN n equals 1 superheating wheels, pure glue by construction. So we have, but now it's not quite pure glue because of this additional D3 brain, it has some, there's a new flavor that's added. So the way to compute the correction that we got, the gauge theory way of doing it would be to integrate out 3 7 strings. In other words, to compute the threshold correction to the superpotential, to the Gugino condensate superpotential. Now, indeed, this is the way we started doing the computation in the warp probe. But if you tried to do it explicitly in the warp probe without actually, I think you're suggesting something about sort of controlling mapping it to flat space. Or, it's clear that you get the exact answer that way, or that?
No, it's not clear, but that's the first thing.
Yeah, good. So, indeed, one knows how to do it in the flat space case, and it works well. And in fact, Bertrand Kempfert did it in the toroidal case, and he got something that wasn't, in the compact but flat case of the torus, they get something that's not trivial. They get some eta functions, et cetera. And what we thought was, well, all right, we'll just go do the same thing in a warp probe. But it turned out not to be particularly easy, because you have to know the whole spectrum of excited D3, D7 strings. In other words, if you have a D3, the 3-7 string down in the throat, you can basically add excitations to it for very little cost, because the wave functions look like this. It has, down where it's highly warped, it can add wiggles for almost no cost. So the number of flavors is gigantic. And then, as a gauge theory computation, it was incredible. If some conformal mapping thing could be done, then that would be also a very slick way of thinking. Okay, so what does this imply?
Yes. So in the first equation of W are the coordinates in the Calabian, and the second equation of the coordinates of the...
On the D3 moduli space. Are the D3...
So what would you like to stop you... Like, so with that equation, like, instead of if f is 0, then say x squared is 0. So like, could you... So say in the first equation, what would be the difference by replacing f by x squared or something? Because that seems to be the same condition.
So it will change here, which... No, it will change the degree of the singularity. I mean, where the 7 brains are sitting, let's say. Or the actual, so if you have an equation like x w1 equals mu, the simplest possible case, so w1 minus mu equals 0, or actually, Dan, would we check factorized cases and see whether it gives the same thing? Because I don't actually remember if we check this case. And it gives this thing to the 2 over n instead of to the 1 over n, the superpotential, right? For any case that isn't factorizable anyhow, well, sorry, your original question was related to what the W, whether the W are the same thing here and there?
Yeah, that's just
okay.
Confirmation.
Good. Okay. Yeah, so in case anyone missed that, this is important. If the rat brains are better than x, w, y equals 0, in other words, here I'm using the W's as the coordinates in this space and telling you where the rat brains sit. In the next equation, I'm using the same function, but the W lines are through the D3 brain positions. In other words, this superpotential vanishes when the D3 brains sit where the racked brains are. So that's the key physical result, which this physical result is that the D3 brains sit on the racked brains and superpotentials are zero. Now, your question of why is F distinguishable from F squared, I guess I thought that in general that would be it is effectively a different device, right? Sort of higher degree. Yeah, let's assess that. Okay, so applications in the last paper. So what does this tell us? It tells us that the superpotential is now some constant times F of W to the 1 over N. So this is where the W dependence, in other words, the D3 brain dependence in the superpotential comes from. And then the Kettle potential has D4. It takes the Wolf Gittings form, rho over XK. Now, what this implies, if you just take that superpotential and that killer potential and try and solve and find minima, you find that there are minima in general on hit points. So where previously the D3 could move over the entire Calabria in a six-dimensional space, now it can only sit hit points. Where those points are, it's not easy to compute if you don't have a metric. Why? Because the killer potential here, this little k here, is the killer potential for the Calabria geometry. So certainly in a part of the Calabria where you don't know the metric, you're not going to know the killer potential. And you can't even say that you know this. So you can't solve, try and find a minima. One could just make genericity statements and try and count points. But in a specific region, like a local region of the throat here, you can actually know the Kettle potential, and you can ask, where are the supersymmetric points? And so we find a supersymmetric point for a D3 brain in the throat is at the tip of the throat only. So D3 brains are very much non-supersymmetric on racked brains. On racked brains, they have very high energy. They're repelled rapidly away from racked brains and down into throat regions, where they're superstructured. So that's one of the physical consequences. So how does this do for inflation? Well, for inflation, we need a rather flat potential. Flat in Planck units, i.e. these slow roll parameters should be small. Derivatives here indicate with respect to a canonically normal field. And the goal of inflation in model building is to realize a Lagrangian with this property. And so here's, the superpotential and Kettle potential looking at. And here's, again, the story we would like to tell. So how does it work? Well, if we hadn't computed this term F here, but it just set it to 1, which is not consistent, but suppose we had done that, then we would have gotten to the slow roll parameter eta, which should be 1 over 60, 1 over 100 or something. We would have gotten 2 things, which is certainly a non-successful one. Dead, completely dead. If you include F, small eta is possible, but is not canon. So that means one can either say, well, these models will never naturally have a flat potential and reject it. And that's, I think, a perfectly reasonable point of view. We're taking the point of view that, well, since the models are fairly concrete, even though they're fine-tuned, we should at least do one more thing, look through the parameter space, and see when can the potential ever be flat in terms of microphysically tunable parameters, you know, the locations of brains, the fluxes, and various other integers that we can choose. So, but of course, it's, that's not a yes.
Well, this if you find the potential from what you have, you will not have any decision bracket, right?
No, not for this alone. This is an anti-decision.
Right. So the after inflation, you will end up in an anti-decision bracket.
So you this picture is, there should be two red dots here. In other words, once the brain has annihilated against the antibrain, there should be an antibrain left.
Right. But doesn't the, if you raise the potential, say another antibrain. Doesn't it change the slow roll for condition?
Yes, but by a small. In other words, so if I didn't have a work throat and I tried to do the same game, then you'd be absolutely right. The antibrain force alone would be enough to spoil it like, rather than make it work. In a warp region, the interaction between the brain and brain is very small, such that the corrections to eta coming from the brain antibrain force are small. So the eta problem here arises from the modulized stabilization effect. If that can be taken care of, which we're in the process of checking means here, searching the parameter space by tweaking parameters until we see if it gets small. If that can be arranged, then one can use this weak interaction and, up to Alex's questions, have a flat interaction. So let me summarize the status of warp brain inflation. It's well known that eta is generically over 1, but our work gives a substantially complete potential what the previous status actually was that this thing f was just treated phenomenologically. One just guessed that it was, well, it's some kind of function, let's try and figure out what kind. Which was, of course, the best one could do, you know, without computation. So, okay, here's the computation, we know what f is, so now we can just direct and check whether it is small for given microscopic parameters. Now, this is explicit fine-tuning, which is still bad, but it's a lot better than implicit or imagined fine-tuning where you don't know what the objects are. So, it's, however, there's no, I'm making no claim of naturalness here. In no way did anything that we computed show that the potential works. But it does do something important. It's not just, all right, now we're satisfied that the model exists, if, even if fine-tuned. The qualitative predictions are different. Because you had an exponentially flat potential before multiply stabilization effects. Adding multiply stabilization, the potential gets corrupted. We're trying to look through the space for a region where it's not very badly corrupted, where it's a little bit flat still. But it won't necessarily, it won't be the same potential we started with. So the slope, well, the spectral index, the tensor amplitude, the cosmic string tension, they'll all be different in general. And it's a challenging task, which we're in part taking on to figure out how those come out. So conclusions, we computed the interaction between D3 brains and rat brains in work rows. Striking cancellations of the non-chiral terms, which can be attributed to holomorphic, led to a simple result that the superpotential correction is just the embedding equation, F. So this is a very explicit confirmation of some work by Ganor. This agrees with earlier work by Birdhock and Kors, which was done in the 3-7 string language, but it allows, basically be done, our method can be pursued in more complicated spaces with flexes and warping. This gives a complete potential for a D3 brain motion in a throat of a KKLT compactification. And so this overcomes the technical obstacle to getting brain inflation in more throats. And it also has some implications for the open string model. Thanks. Oh, and let me mention my collaborators because I blew past it at the start. One of them is Daniel, who's here. So Daniel Baumann, who's here, Anatoly Demarski and Arvin Murugan, both students at Princeton, and Igor Konovalov.
I'm a little bit confused by, you said it very quickly. So basically the computation you do, let's restrict to the model you have. So basically an infinite row, right? And so my understanding was that that thing is dual to some conformal field theory. I want to translate your statement in a gauge field theory, and that's one of my puzzle is. So you're saying that without the seven brains, right, the D3 brain had a moduli space, right? So now you introduce the seventh brain, and that somehow produced a potential that forced my D3 brain to move to the gate force. So in the context of the ADS-GFT, that's of course when I have a gauge dual, right? And before I introduce a fundamental matter, I have modular space. Now I have supersymmetric gauge theory. Now we're introducing flavors, and that somehow leaves the modular space. I don't know any single example where this is.
Exactly. So the reason you wouldn't, I mean, the one would not generally find such things, is that this is a. It was certainly not clear from the formulas that I gave, but this is the Planck suppressed effect.
But
that is not something
you can. I'm looking at field theory explanation of this phenomenon. I mean, if
you would not see it, you would not see it in a non-compact description. So in a non.
But
so
your arguments were in a non-compact description.
Yeah,
that's the only place.
Right, but we what we checked was the following. So let me make that point before I explain why arguments do work. The reason that you can't use the non-compact gauge theory to do the computation is that the effect goes to zero in strictly non-compact gauge theory because it depends on the point. So if you have something like this, I consider the associated gauge theory with infinite point mass, the effect diminishes to zero. So now what we did is the following. We had some embedded D7 brain, and we figured out, so we know the Green's function. How does the Green's function for the D3 brain depend on the radial coordinate? So we knew what that was. And what we had to do was integrate that over this rat brain. And what we found, and given our paper, is that integral gets all the support here, not up there. So the support dies away very rapidly toward the ultraviolet end of the throat. which means that if we do this, if we imagine capping the whole thing off with something like this to make the flight path finite, then we can certainly trust the computation that depends only on that region. So effectively, we don't need to know much about what's up here, except that it makes the flight path finite. However, I think for the dual gauge theory computation, this is actually an important region. And so that prevents me from quite understanding how to get this result. It is quite surprising. We were very surprised that it decouples. But one can just look at how does the Green's function diminish, and then how does this volume grow, and indeed, you fold them together, and the net result is what was.
So it would be very interesting when you clear off things with the finite volume effects that you said you were working, because those are the things that might be
available. Yeah, it would certainly be interesting to understand. I believe that this is not an effect one would expect to see in gauge theory. It's a fine thing. It has the fine capacity. Other questions?
Well, in this picture, in all these warped pictures, where do you, from this viewpoint, where is the standard model brain?
So that's due to some very nice work by several groups. So the key question is, if you put the standard model somewhere, can you reheat that standard model for brain annihilation?
Well,
there are two possible questions. One is, can one build a satisfactory model in a type 2D warp computation?
Well, I'm moving in a different direction.
Okay.
If it's if it's related to the F theory,
mm-hmm.
then there must be D7 intersecting D7 brains. And I would say that's where the standard model is.
Could well be.
But this is a global object, so why are they far away from the throat?
Well, they're not quite, it's not clear that every D7 brain stretches into the throat, right? Certainly, it's not, these D7 brains are complex one dimension one. They're not space filling. They don't fill the quality out. So they're intersecting all sorts of places.
No, they have space. I mean space filling.
Space time.
Well, I mean they wrap something on Calabi-Yau. They intersect there, but they are space filling.
Space time.
Yes, space time.
Okay, fine. So they are.
So this D3 brain, for example, does it interact with them in any way?
No. It can interact with them. One can do the interaction with those. One can understand that interaction by this bulk computation. I mean, if the D3 say it annihilates with an antibrain in the OPU, you have some closed strings moving around. Those closed strings have to find their way through the bulk to the location of these intersecting brains. So that's exactly the reheating computation is the question of can you reheat a standard model sitting somewhere else with brain annihilation in the throat.
But are you sure you can make it in such a way that they sit somewhere else?
Well, the alternative, the opposite of that statement would be that any intersecting brains always sit in the throat. I don't think that's right. I think they would generically sit, somewhere up in his head, you're up in the ball. This, by the way, this picture is a little bit inaccurate. What I really should have done is drawn a bit more like this. Well, the leading effect for our purposes comes from whichever D7 brain goes farthest into the throat. So as long as the intersecting ones are up here, then they will give some of the interactions.
Okay, one last question. So you talked about making predictions from these models. To the extent that you're making contact with inflation through some sort of a slow roll model, it seems like your predictions are going to have to be a subset of what you've got in class and field theories. And so, a naive expectation would be that if I take the region in the phenomenological plane people look at is the tensor progressions against the spectral index, there's a region that, say, hybrid inflation will fill and slow and large inflation will fill. Now, if you vary through all the parameters in these various print factors, you would have thought that it's plausible that you would explore all of this two-dimensional plane and the parameters that are available in the field theories. And so the stringy predictions you're looking for, you said, were to do with there being discrete spaces amongst the various places you would arrange that you would find in
right.
the string theory. So the question is, does there exist any other example like that, where you really have a discrete spacing in the string theory that was actually giving you some sort of an interestingly wide range that you can compare to not allowed to get anything?
There may well be this one. I'm not. None springs to mind right now, because in general one has, even in this case, there are more issues that have to be thought about. In every one of these, let me make two comments about that. One is the spacing between those different points in the NSR plane is not, we're not saying that it's guaranteed to be small. It could be a very, very fine space. But at least in principle, we know we're talking about the right objects. We're tuning integers. If we look down to the basic level of finding integer inputs, then we know we're tuning the right object by tuning those. So that's really what the dots is worth. That's why it's nice to have a lattice of these models. The other comment is, if your suggestion is realized that field theory models descending from string theory actually explore the whole field theory space, then I would be deeply disappointed, because that would mean that there's no way of extracting any kind of prediction from string theory. Now, of course, what I was doing here was not per se stringing. I was computing corrections to the low energy effect. So if I want to get some interest in, if I want to exclude the possibility that the same effect of action arose from field theory, well, I would have to see some strikingly string effect, and that's not likely except through cosmic strings. So the alternative is to explore this whole space of possible models and find that string theory models tend to be supportive on certain subregions of them. Then if you find that in reality we're in one subregion where there are a lot of string models, you might say, oh, well, okay, it could be a stringy model, let's keep looking into it. On the other hand, string models uniformly fill the available space of field theory Lagrange models, then there's pretty much nothing to do. There's almost no gain in realizing the models in string theory. You might as well just write down the field theory model from the start. However, I strongly believe, for other reasons that you might hear about from Daniel on Thursday, that string theory models don't hold.
Okay, so that's a plug for next.